Okay, running the recording of this so that if while I'm putting this thing back together,
I will know when everything stops operating. I'm putting the tape back across the transformer. That's in place. I'm going to. I just pulled the mic cord through the mounting hole, get it out of the way. Now I'm putting my plate, transformer, and mic line all back in position. There. Screwdriver. And then I'll put that top screw in first. Quit swinging mic against the wall. It'll make a terrible noise, I bet you. Okay, putting the screws in. The bottom one. I ain't left at all. It'll still be functioning when I get done messing around here. I think one thing I will do is wrap some tape around the body of that microphone. Just in case that's shorting off something once it's inside there. Let's see. Here's the bottom piece of tape. All right. Okay, we'll wrap a piece of tape. I imagine what was wrong was I took that mic apart and cleaned it up, and I probably fixed it. Just in case. He's stuffing the wire, microphone wire back into the hole now. That's 3 or 4 inches of it. There, now the microphone itself. Okay, there, the microphone's in place. Hopefully everything's working. Okay.
But if you're on the Earth, Back to 500 BC. 500 years before the time of Christ. There's usually not very much difficulty in dating any archaeological artifact that's found during those times. There are a lot of papyri that have been discovered in Egypt, and a lot of historians that have written. We've got Roman historians during the period of Christ, Antonius and Tacitus, and a number of others. You have Greek historians, Herodotus, and a number of others. So you have a lot of good historians there that are recording things, and plus the fact that you have a lot of pieces of history from different cultures that you can fit together, inscriptions and monuments and so forth, that make it quite easy to date things up to about 500 BC. Dating before this time is a lot less sure. It gets more difficult the further back you go. And one of the chronologies, and one of the tools that is used in ancient archaeology and dating is the Egyptian chronology. Of course, the most archaeological artifacts do come from Egypt, for reasons that we'll discuss later. And so the Egyptian chronology is very important. And the work of a man named Manetho is very important when we get into Egyptian chronology. M-A-N-E-T-H-O. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. Manetho or Manetho. He was a man who lived during the middle of the 3rd century B.C. He lived during the middle of the 3rd century B.C., which would be the 200-something B.C., about 250 B.C. thereabouts. He's an Egyptian historian. He divided the Egyptian history from about 3000 B.C. on into 31 dynasties of rulers. So he went way back to 3000 B.C. and went on from there and divided Egyptian history into 31 dynasties of rulers. 31 dynasties or family, group families of rulers.
Huh?
3000 B.C. We'll talk about that date in a while. Why was it like that?
He divided what?
He divided the history of Egypt from 3000 B.C. on into 31 dynasties of rulers.
Oh.
31 dynasties. Now, dynasties, D-Y-N-A-S-T-Y. A dynasty is a family rulership, a ruling family. Like today, we probably say like the Kennedy dynasty or something like that. The number of rulers, the family that we're going to call it, corresponds to what happened back there. And the Romans had like the Flavians and so forth, the different families that were ruling the family, right? And the Chinese, of course, very common. Okay. Now he divided these things up. Now only fragments of his work remain. Most of our knowledge of his work, Manetho's work, comes from quotes from others. We don't have a lot of genuine documents of what he actually did. And only fragments of quotations of his work remains. We don't have everything that he did. And his chronology, especially in the early times, when he gets back around 3000 B.C., his chronology, as we know now, were wrong because he failed to take into account contemporary dynasties. He failed to take into account the fact that a lot of these kingdoms were going on at the same time. They'd have two rulers. They'd have a ruler in the north part of Egypt and another ruler in the south part of Egypt, and he would have these two rulers. He'd mention them two separate rulers and have them ruling at different times, you know, stretching it all out, when actually they were both ruling at the same time. And so his chronology was stretched out a lot longer than it actually took, because they had a lot of these kings ruling at the same time, and he didn't take this into account. And now they know, they're getting more evidence, and they know that a lot of these kings were ruling at the same time. This is why he stretched way back to 3000 B.C. when the history of Egypt probably doesn't go back that far. The flood was probably about 2600 B.C. Okay. And this is why beware of dynasty charts in books. In books that you find in archaeology and so forth, beware of these dynasty charts that go and tell you all the dynasties of the Egyptian rulers all the way back. And because they're not that accurate. And they're based on a lot of sketchy information of Manetho. We know for sure already that a lot of his work was wrong because of contemporary dynasties. And a lot of the kings ruling at the same time in different parts of Egypt. Okay. But this, for later history, once you get past, get into later history of the Egyptian kings, his work is useful. Because it's more accurate and more useful later. It's just talking about when you get back down in 2 and 3000 BC, where things go haywire. Now, also helpful when we're talking about Egyptian chronology is what they call the Sothic cycle. The Sothic cycle. Now, this topic cycle in Egypt has to do with the fact that the early Egyptians adopted a 365-day year, and they had no leap year. They didn't have a leap year in their year. They had 365 days. So you can see what's going to happen. Just running 365 days in a row and no break and no leap year to take into account the fact that every 4 years, of course, we have to take an extra day because the year, the actual solar year, is about 365 and one quarter days long. And they didn't account for this. They didn't have a leap year. And so over a period of years, the New Year's Day would move around the time of the season of the year because they never had something to take it, never had a leap year stuck in there to keep things back, you know, to where it should be. And so over a period of years, the New Year's Day or any given day would drift around the seasons of the year. Like your birthday, you know, might be you might have been born in the winter, but your birthday might go through the summer and all through the different states of the year because of the way they never had a leap year is taking into account. Okay. Well, this is kind of useful though for dating purposes, yes, huh?
Like what's the year that the topic cycle started?
We don't know. It's just something that the ancient Egyptians did. We don't know exactly when they began it. This is part of the problem in the chronology of it too. I'll mention it again. But the principle is that every 4 years, of course, they'd be one day off. Every 4 years, New Year's Day would be another on the next day. I'm not sure how they divided up the part days, but in every 4 years, of course, our leap year, we have to take an extra day in order to keep the seasons right. But for them, every 4 years, they didn't have a leap year in there, of course, so their seasons are gradually be drifting. And actually, the cycle is 4 times 365, because it takes four years for it to move one day. You've got 365 days in the year, which comes out to about 1,460 years. In 1,460 years, the New Year's, any one given day will have gone all the way around the days of the year and come back to its original point. 1,460 years. Now, it's not important that you understand all of this, but one ancient historian claimed that the new cycle began in 140 to 144 AD. So some historian made this claim that the Egyptian Sothic cycle began during this time again, and so they used that as a point in order to find out where the cycle was, and then they can go back, you know, 1460 years and back and so forth and see where New Year's Day was on any given year. Now, suppose they find some inscriptions that give the time of the year when New Year's Day fell, then they could date them on the basis of these Sothic cycles. If they know what year the New Year's Day fell during this cycle, they can figure out how many years ago it was when that day came to that certain point. See? And they could theoretically, you know, be a very accurate thing in determining how many years old things were. The problem, however, is that nobody's certain about this thing. They got it from one historian, and nobody's really positive when this Sothic cycle actually began, and we just have to kind of take the word for it. There's no Egyptian records of the Sothic cycle. We don't have any of the Egyptians' records themselves, and we don't even know when the calendar was invented, so these dates are unreliable. We don't even know how far back the Sothic cycle began to be being used. So it's something that looks good on the surface, but there's just not enough good tie-ins in order to be, it theoretically would be very useful if we had a real good tie-in date and we knew when they began the thing.
Let me see if I get it straight. You're saying that in 140 to 144 AD, the historians stated that's when the Sothic cycle started. So the ancient Egyptians were
No, that's when a new cycle began.
When a new cycle
of 1460 years began. In other words, he fixed this at a time when New Year's Day was such and such a time. He fixed the time of New Year's Day there. See. So if that was correct, see, we could go back and we'd have it all the way back and just be working these cycles back and figure out where things were. But that has come into question. They're not too sure whether he was correct on that, of course, because the Egyptians, we don't have any Egyptian records to tie into it. You kind of have to take his word this more.
Well, did he say then that the New Year's that began in 144 AD is the same as our New Year's? That way he does.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it would be the same as our New Year's, but he had the date fixed to a certain, you know, time astronomically or something like that, where they could make a correspondence between their New Year and our New Year and know where it was. So it was a fixing point. I'm not sure if exactly he used the same day or what.
How did he come to this 140, 144 A.D.?
I'm not sure.
Get it out of the air.
He was a historian, you know, and this is just something that they have, a statement from a historian that said this, see, and we really don't know whether he had access to, maybe had access to some Egyptian records that we don't have access to now, or how he got it.
Do we know who he was?
Let's see, I don't have the name of him. You could probably find out if you did some research on it. It's not real important here because there's so many other inaccuracies that I didn't want to give you, you know.
Yeah. This wasn't a present day historian, this
is
an ancient.
No, this is an ancient historian.
Actually, it would be too difficult for them. All you have to do is go a particular given date by the Egyptian calendar, and then know it's also by another time system that you deal with it.
That's right. But see, that's where the problem comes, because we don't have the records of the Egyptian Sophic cycle, see. And we have the records of their date, but they usually dated things according to the year of a certain king. So we can, that's actually the more accurate way to go. But if this Sophic cycle theoretically would work, and we don't know how far back the Egyptians were reckoning things by this either. So, you know, if we get a date beyond the time when they started this thing, it's not going to help either. So it was something that, you know, that they tried to, you know, make some pinpoints too, but it really hasn't worked out as well as they'd like. Yes, Mr. Scott?
You said that the Egyptians themselves have no, at least as far as we know.
We have no records of their.
So it's what they're going by, but the records of other nations?
Yeah, the records of other nations and statements that they found, I'm not sure exactly whether they're documents and so forth about the thing, but we don't have actually the calendar type records that Egyptians kept and so forth to know where to fix these things. They probably got inscriptions that tell them that they did this kind of thing, but they don't have any fixed points, you know, where they can start to fit dates in and really ascertain things accurately. Okay. So there's assumptions involved in this thing, and you have to assume that this guy's right now. Notice that he's got a 4-year span here, and you can only get it within 4 years because you know, it depends on where they stuck that new day. You can't start a new day in the middle of a day, see, or 3/4 of a day, or half a day. You know, it's got to go, you know, from one day to the next day. So 4 years later. So they're not sure exactly where in that period of 4 years the actual new year fell. And any date that they get this way would have to only be accurate to within 4 years. Okay. Now, astronomy is another method that's used, and is useful in archaeology in certain cases, usually rarely, because you have to find an inscription or something that will mention some eclipse or some unusual event, and the astronomer can figure out how long ago this event happened, you know, by just the timetable of the stars. They can figure out, know, when this must have been. Suppose they find some Egyptian inscription that mentions an eclipse of the sun that took place during the reign of this king. They can go back and calculate how many eclipses have occurred and so forth, and kind of pinpoint the time when this would have had to be, and they can pin it right down to the day and the hour, very, very time when it had to be. So that can be a very, very accurate method if there's enough stated, you know, in the inscription to pinpoint the type of phenomenon, type of event that took place.
Bible descriptions you're talking about?
Historical, just anything that's inscribed on a monument or something, and some event, some cataclysmic event that took place or something like that. It has to be descriptive enough, you know, and the location and so forth, so that they know where the observation was being made from and so forth.
Think of body
eclipses. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. They can understand the motions of the things, and they can tell when things coincide and line up. Barring any unforeseen astronomical catastrophes. Which things that we know have taken place in the past, too, which is another problem. Of course, if you believe the evolutionary concept, things have happened, you know, they wouldn't even be in the things. But if we believe what the Bible indicates, and we see phenomena out there in our very solar system with planets having retrograde motion and satellites going in the wrong direction around the planets that they orbit around, in order to violating the, you know, the idea of the conservation of angular momentum. If this thing evolved from a swirling gas, like you normally say, which is impossible, violates all of the laws of angular momentum. The whole solar system is a violation of this thing. You can't figure out how. I think all five moons, you know, Uranus moons go in the wrong direction, and I think the outer four of Jupiter's moons go the inner. The inner eight go one direction, the outer four go the other direction. And everything should be rotating in the same direction if it all was broken off and spun off from the particle of gas. And they can't figure out the retrograde motion of why it won't actually touch. The only solution other than creation is some violent catastrophe taking place in the atmosphere, numerous violent catastrophes taking place, which again is something they don't like to even talk about. So they're really stuck with it. And the rings of Saturn is another thing that that looks very much like a satellite disintegrated, and the astral shape limit or something that disintegrated itself and made a beautiful ring of Saturn. So that's not necessarily that God could have made it that way just in the first place, just to see. But there's plenty of evidence out there for a lot of catastrophes going on. Okay, another method that's used by the archaeologists in dating things is what's called sequence dating. Sequence dating having to do with pottery. And this is another one that can get into problems at times. A man named Flinders Petrie was the one who first suggested this method. We'll have Jason to mention him a number of times in the class. You'll get to know some of the major archaeologists pretty well by the time we're done. The Flinders Petrie suggested and developed a system of dating by means of pottery style. Dating by means of pottery style. And it's based on the fact that pottery was very common, of course, and everyone had pottery. It was a very necessary item for the culture and the way people lived. And it was not reusable, of course, once it was broken. And so the styles changed often. People had to get new pottery quite often because it broke quite often. And as they were getting, something that there was a lot of turnover in pottery, and so the styles, of course, have changed a lot. Like a new car that changed every year. And so a lot of the styling would change in pottery. And so if one could try to establish a sequence in the styles of pottery in a certain mound, for example, say there were 20 different levels in this particular mound, and you saw a certain style of pottery in level number one and different style in number two and three and four and so forth, you might be able to, if you knew the date, if you knew the dates of these strata by some other method, you could, if you found the same sequence in another strata, you could assign these things to the same date based on the same similar style of pottery. If you found another strata that had this pottery very similar to the style of the strata you found over here that you know how old it is because of some other inscription or something, then you could assign this to the same date or the same period, assuming, of course, the style being the same, in these areas. And so this method has been criticized by a lot of other archaeologists, and it's not entirely reliable, but it's been used quite frequently. And so it's not the best method, but it is a possible method. It gets the problem when they begin to stretch things into evolutionary sequences of pottery style. It's one thing to have sequences of styles, and styles change and times change. But when they begin to stretch things further and begin to apply through evolution to it, and getting more, pottery going from not from one style to another, but from crude to more complex, and trying to assign this kind of thing, this is where things get pretty wild.
You just about have to establish a new dating method for every area and culture, too.
That's right. Every place you go, so you got to establish another way to sequence it, of course. And then assume that anything that's something else you find in that area, it fits the same pattern. And it gets really shaky because you really... something entirely independent might have gone on over there. You might have some similar styles, of course, but there aren't too many different styles of pottery you can actually come up with. How many different ways can you make a pot? And certainly, just by chance, you could have some correspondence, and you might be lining these up in kind of a set date by them, and then it's really not valid at all. And that's part of the criticism that has been raised against this method by the archaeologists themselves. So they're not by any means all in agreement on sequence dating by pottery. The ones that are more evolutionary tend to put more emphasis on things like this. The ones that are more sensible, they don't. Okay. Now, one of the more accurate and most valuable of the methods of dating is the king list in chronology. Actual chronologies and lists of kings and the reigns of kings that have been found. And when we're talking about the period from 2000 BC on, which is about the limit as far as accuracy and dates at all, these are the most valuable and accurate dates. They come from correlating reigns of kings in various countries. a list of, you know, they'll find kings, lists of kings and the reigns of kings, so forth, how many years they've reigned and so forth, and years of such and such a king. And oftentimes there'll be correspondences between one country and another. For example, if some transaction took place or a battle took place between two kings of two different nations, there might be a record of this, and such a battle took place in the year of, in such and such a year of this king, you know. And he battled with this other king in this year. So we know that this other guy must have been living at the same time here. If we know the time of this one, you can assess the time of the other one. And then you can get a fix on the dates of the others. And maybe you'll find a list for this other nation, and you can begin to start to assess things and cross-correspond these things. And this is usually the most accurate way when you after you take into account the fact that a lot of them lie and a lot of them, you know, try to get glory to themselves and so forth. But still, just the mentioning and the mention of the names and things, sometimes they can make correspondences between countries. And some of these ancient historians would leave valuable lists of kings and chronologies. And of course, the Bible, of course, has this as the most valuable of all. But other nations did the same type of things. They would have books of chronicles of kings and the events that took place in the lives of kings. And it's very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
So this, the strength of this lies in correlations between
them. Right. That's the important thing, is just having a number of independent sources and drawing correlations between them. And lots of times, you know, you'll be able to weed out the things that are lies and the things that are, you know, misrepresentations this way. And sometimes the astronomy will sometimes fix a key date, you know. And once you've got a good key fix, maybe by astronomy or some other more accurate method, then you can kind of interpolate things along the line from chronologies and king lists, and then knowing how they fit in battles and with other kings and tying them together. So it's complicated, but it's like putting a big jigsaw puzzle together and finding these little pieces and trying to make correspondence to them. And, that's actually the most accurate method that they do have of getting dates to the ancient commands. Of course, you've always got an error margin in it. Now, carbon 14 is another one. But this is highly questionable. Carbon 14 is also used to date objects, but it's limited for several reasons. First of all, it's limited to living think matter that was either once alive or was once alive in one form or another, either plant material or animal material. You can't date pots. You can't date anything that was made by man by carbon 14. It has to be dated something that was organic, was once living. Also, any dates before the flood are very questionable because of the conditions before the flood. You know, these are not evolutionary conditions.
But if they made a pot or something, why did they do that?
Oh, yeah, they could probably do that. They could, you know, put a fly inside the pot or something like that. But it'd be something rare to find. Normally, you can't use carbon 14 to date anything unless it was something organic and something that died at that time. Because they couldn't date a piece of something that was made out of a bone. All they could do is maybe try to date the bone, and when that animal died, that wouldn't tell them, you know, that bone could have been laying around for 100 years before, you know, somebody made something out of it. And the date that you'd be getting was when that animal was alive, you know, if you were seeing a date at all. But carbon 14 is highly questionable. There's a lot of assumptions associated with it, and it's proven to be very, very inaccurate. They dated, I believe, a living mollusk, you know, 3,000 years old, with carbon 14. So it's very, very highly questionable.
So carbon 14 is where they try and guess by the date by finding dead objects, dead insects, and things like
right,
that.
Right, dead animals. It's used mainly for dead animal remains and trying to tell how old that animal is by radioactive methods. But the problem is not with the radioactive equipment or anything. The problem is with the assumptions that you apply to the situation in the first place. It's not a matter of measuring. It's not a matter of inaccurate equipment. That's the least of the problems, although that can be a problem too. But it's a problem if the assumptions apply.
Well, they use this then on all the dinosaur bones.
Yeah. Even dinosaur bones, they can't quite because most of them are too old to have anything in them to even, you know, click on the guy's counter. You know, according to their thing. But it's probably because most of them were there before the flood, and they wouldn't have gotten any radiation in the first place, and they wouldn't have been long, long, vastly older than they actually are. So most of it is with human bones. That's where they use carbon 14 more than anything else. Trying to assess human evolution. And even then, they're in fact, recently they've been trying to check carbon 14 with tree ring dating in order to get some accuracy out of it because it's really been frustrating. It's really turned out. In fact, carbon 14 has some very serious implications about the age of the Earth, and get certain things in carbon-14 dating, and think that they've assumed an equilibrium carbon-14 concentration in the atmosphere, and they've recently made some measurements. They just assumed that this was so because it only takes 30,000 years for the Earth to reach equilibrium once it's created. But and of course they said, well, obviously the Earth is over 30,000 years old. But now they're finding, they just found out and made measurements and proven that carbon-14 has not reached equilibrium yet, and the concentration is still increasing in the atmosphere, which implies the Earth is less than 30,000 years old, and something that they don't like to admit. The carbon-14 is working the other way. They don't talk too much about it. The emphasis is really coming off of carbon-14 now. Okay, someone else had a question.
You want to discuss that as far as
I think we'll have a teaching tutor here when we talk about the flood. So I'll move back to right there at this moment that we'll talk about.
Mike, did you get an article, or have you heard about the, I've even forgotten the location, but there's thousands of trees that have thousands and thousands of rings in
the bristle cone pine?
Yeah.
Yeah, they found some trees, and these trees are very interesting because they go right up to about 4,500 years old. Mm-hmm. They all stop right there.
Exactly.
There's nothing older than 4,500. And that's about the time the flood was in.
About that time.
It's very strange. And see, the thing is, they don't know, there's no known diseases or things that attack these things, and there's no known reason why they shouldn't live forever. See, there's no known definite lifespan that they have, and so they've got them to go down to 4,500 years and nothing older than that.
Although they're really quite concerned about them right now.
Are they being attacked by disease and things now?
Pollution? They're really quite concerned about it. They don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're in California.
Yeah, they got them in California. They're really strange looking trees.
What are they called?
Ripple cone pine.
They're pretty big.
They're not real big. They're not like a sequoia or anything like that. But
they look like a hemlock tree that's been stunted.
Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it kind of all fits the whole pattern now that they're finally dying off, you know, and having problems now because we're approaching right at the end. The coal and the oil was both supplied probably at the time of the flood. The vast amount of vegetation that existed, and the luxurious vegetation that existed on the Earth before the flood, being compressed and packed together to supply all the coal that we have today. And the tremendous marine life before that time being compacted and pressed together with sediments would form oil deposits. Most of them, they know most of the oil comes from marine life. And so the Lord, you know, provided at the time of the flood for the fuel needs of the world, and just gave enough supply, you know, that would be needed until he came. And so we're running out now. Another thing in the time of need, and that was the end of near. Okay, but just to kind of sum up the dating methods here, dates before 2000 BC, approximately, kind of the cutoff point, are highly questionable in my judgment. And you don't necessarily have to agree with me on this. If you wanted to venture into that other unknown area and accept what a lot of the evolutionists have said about it and accept their assumptions, that's fine. But before you do, I suggest going through the evolution education class and seeing what kind of assumptions that they use and have the base on these things are. There's very, very little evidence, and most of it just purely based on assumption and when man would have evolved, you know, and so forth at this point, and then they fix the date for it like that. But there's nothing there as far as historical evidence or anything else. You're limited to about 2000 BC as far as actual historical things that you can put your finger on.
Mm-hmm. What is the limit for today's
Approximately 4,500 years ago, about 2,500 BC, approximately 2,600 BC would be about the time of the flood, plus or minus a few years. You know, there's been arguments made about the gaps in the genealogy and so forth, but they can't go too far one way or the other, in my estimation. And actually, there's no reason, I found no reason to stretch anything further back than what the Bible has actually indicated. Of course, now there was life and civilization before the flood, too, that's to be taken into account. But of the actual civilizations of man, you know, if you look at most of your history books, they'll make a lot of all kinds of, you know, grandiose assumptions and things up until the time now, and then as soon as they get around 2,500 BC or so now, then they'll begin to start talking about Sumerians and talking about actual civilizations and historical history and recorded history. And recorded history only goes back about that time, just the time of flood. So And when we look at the flood and we look at some of the things that have been found and things that fit in and things that how things began, when you look at the ziggurats that were built by the Mesopotamians and the pyramids that were built by the Egyptians all right at the same time, you know, right after the Tower of Babel, you know, just correspondences all the way across that are very striking and seem to all fit together. So as far as the biblical chronology and the biblical timetable, there's no problem at all between that and actual archaeological discoveries and things that they've actually found. Things that are historically there. There is conflict with a lot of the evolutionary assumptions and stretching things beyond, you know, what they actually have the evidence for. But all the evidence fits right into it. And all of a sudden, your civilizations all of a sudden seem to come from nowhere. We'll look at when we look at Egypt. All of a sudden, Egypt seems to be there from nowhere, starting out as a grand civilization, and then gradually getting worse and worse and decaying. It's not a history of something evolving into a grand civilization. It's not something that starts out highly developed and then decays, works downward.
What I was looking for was a reference point.
Okay, well, the flood would be about 2,500 years, but the actual creation is about 6,000 years ago at this point, right, from the very beginning. As far as the actual existence of man on Earth, it's about 6,000 years ago. And of course, that we're coming right at the end of the 6,000 years, and God's timetable, one day is 1,000 years, is one day, and one day is 1,000 years. And we're entering right into the 7,000 year period of the millennium. You know, it all fits. It fits too close to me to believe that it's 5,576 years. You know, it's just the way God does things, and just knowing the heart of God, it's just everything lines up and fits right into this plan. And I don't have any problems as far as the evolutionary ideas and all of these things, because they're all based on assumptions and faulty evidence anyway. And they're based on an attempt to try to deny these things. Now, as far as the actual age of the Earth, we don't know. There's no way to know exactly how old the Earth is. That depends on how long the days of creation were. But in my estimation, there's no reason to assume that they're any longer than a day. Or in God's time, you can do it in a fraction of a second. God doesn't need millions of years to do things. You know? And as far as the ages of the Earth, based on radioactive dating, all of these things are based on assumptions of concentrations of the rocks and the composition of the rocks at the time of creation. And if there were lead in the rocks, you know, when God created them, it would throw the whole thing off too again. So there's just a lot of assumptions that are based to stretch the age of the Earth out. And to me, I just can't see it. There's no problem. I mean, I wouldn't argue with anyone. But, you know, that's up to God. And one of these days, we'll know for sure. But knowing God, I'm not bound to try to stretch things out and make things try to fit the evolutionary concept of them.
Along with carbon 14, Mike, there is another point that's embarrassing for scientists.
Right. That's another thing I could just point out to you. I'm glad you mentioned that, Fred. They have dated the Earth based on helium and trying to get a maximum, an upper bound. Helium is given off in radioactive decay as one of the decay products. And in almost all radioactive decay processes, alpha emission. And they make calculations as to the amount of helium in the atmosphere, and there's no known way for helium to escape the Earth's atmosphere. And they make calculations of the total amount of helium in the atmosphere and in the rock, and the helium trapped in the rocks in the Earth, and there's just not enough helium for the Earth to be any older than 12,000 years as a maximum. And there's no way. Now, the evolutionists have said somehow the helium's escaping, but there's no evidence of helium escaping, and no one has any measurements of the rate of the escape of helium. In fact, we know full well that helium is entering into the atmosphere from the sun. Most of the helium from the Earth comes from the sun. That's what it's called helium. Helium it comes from helios, meaning the sun, the Greek word meaning the sun. And so we know helium is impinging, coming into the atmosphere, and that even makes the problem even more difficult, you know, pushes the age of the Earth even younger, because we've got more helium coming in from the outside. And this is considerably embarrassing, of course, and it's usually you never hear anything about it, they just kind of write it off as an anomaly of some sort, and it just doesn't fit their assumption.
I was just going to mention that book, Genesis Flood, that last year, mm-hmm. That was fantastic.
Yeah, if you have any questions about along these lines about the age of the Earth and geology, especially the geological aspect of evolution, read that book, The Genesis Flood, or get a hold of it in the library, and it will answer a lot of the questions that we've been talking about.
When will be the end of the
Well, it's coming.
Date-wise?
Well,
have any idea? I'm just curious in mind to
Don't look for it to be, you know, right, you know, an exact year, you know.
Yeah, right.
But people have made some interesting calculations, and you know, when Jesus said this generation shall not pass, so he's going to pass. And according to everything that the Bible indicates, we're in that generation, and we'll be within the next couple of decades. We're approaching right up to that time. It just doesn't have to be anything else. Everything else, the whole world is falling into the same place. So, you know, I would say within the next 40 years or so, we'll see the culmination of everything that's been ordained and ready.
I was just wondering how accurate our dating is.
Yeah, well, we know that there are errors in the calendar and that we are further ahead than we think. I think we're actually up in, 1988 or something, something like that. We're actually closer to the year 2000 than we would be because of that, because of errors in the calendars and because of the number of days in the year and so forth, the way it might have been reckoned. We don't know for sure now, we know one thing, the time is approaching, and the signs that we've seen in Israel and all these other things let us know that Jesus, when you see the fig tree budding, you know the time is near. All the signs are coming to pass just this way, but it's dangerous sometimes to try to push too soon, too, you know, realize that a lot of things can happen, and God has ways of, you know, of interceding, and he's long-suffering, trying to get as many in as possible before he wraps it up. So God will many times intercede in history, and I'm sure that there'll be a world government long before this if we're not for the intercession of God. And holding back a lot of these things in the spiritual Christians, holding back the forces that are working to bring these things together. Okay. But the Bible is the most accurate and reliable chronology of all of these things. And we'll see that you can assess in 6 dates by the Bible. The date of the Exodus, for example, we'll be talking about. It's been disputed, but it's really a simple problem when you look at it from the standpoint of Scripture. It can't be anything other than, you know, there can be a little error margin there, but it can't be other than, to use the Bible as the accurate chronology is the principle that we use throughout the class. And we'll see that it has been verified, and it's the only one that fits with all the others. Now, this is not going to be a detailed class in archaeology itself, but it'll be a course designed primarily to show how archaeology confirms the historicity and accuracy of the Bible. So we're going to be covering many periods of biblical history and examining what specifically archaeology has found that bears on the situation. So we'll look at different periods of history and time in the scriptures, and then we'll see what archaeology has found that bears right on that situation. I want to give you just read a few quotations to you by a number of noted archaeologists and what they had to say about the Bible. Just listen to these, I think, would be best do at this time. Dr. W.F. Albright, who is one of the foremost Palestinian archaeologists of the century, says that archaeology has confirmed the substantial historicity of the Old Testament tradition. Now, he's pretty liberal most of the time, but he's always tried to take the liberal side of things whenever he gets a chance. But he still admits that the archaeology has confirmed the substantial historicity of the Old Testament tradition. Another man, Nelson Bluek, G-L-U-E-C-K, we'll have occasion to mention him numerous times in the class. He's a Jewish archaeologist, and he said that no archaeological discovery has ever contradicted or avoided a biblical reference. No archaeological discovery has ever contradicted or avoided a biblical reference. Another man named Miller Burroughs of Yale University said that archaeology has unquestionably strengthened confidence in the reliability of the scriptural record. In many cases, it has refuted the views of modern critics. That's really an understatement, because we'll be looking at the numbers. Miller Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S, from Yale University. No, I don't believe any of these that I've read here are. Most of them have, and as I said, almost all of them have a liberal tendency in them. But yet they're admitting these things. And this is why the quotations are valuable. Okay. Let's begin then with Moses and the Pentateuch in the Old Testament, the first 5 books of the Old Testament, the writings of Moses, and see what archaeology has to show us about these things. Now the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible, especially the book of Genesis, have been vigorously attacked by the liberals, primarily because of the Genesis account of creation and flood and the origin of the Hebrew religion and so forth. In other words, anything supernatural is attacked, of course, by those that are skeptical and don't believe in miracles and don't believe in God and the power of God. And so Genesis, of course, is one of the most attacked books in the Bible. Now, one of the ways to attack the book of Genesis, especially in the early days, was to say that Moses was not the author of the book of Genesis, but rather that it was a book compiled by later men from several sources. And this is the higher critical hypothesis that the books of the Bible, almost whether it be the books of the Pentateuch or any other books, were not written by who the Bible said they were written by, but somebody else in later time, and compiled from a number of different sources and tried to fit together to make it look like it's something that's good. This is what the liberals have charged, and they still charge concerning these things. But for a long time, the critics said that Moses couldn't possibly have written the Pentateuch because writing had not been invented at that early date. This was one of their first arguments. They said Moses couldn't have written it because writing was not invented at the time that Moses lived, and so how could Moses have written something if writing hadn't been invented yet? Now, they had no evidence for this other than assumption, because as yet nothing other than the Bible was discovered in writing during those times. There was no archaeological evidence of writing existing back in those times, other than the Bible, which they denied, and so they could pretty well get away with a statement like that. You know, they could say, well, writing hadn't been invented yet. We don't have any evidence that writing had been invented at that time. And so they assumed the Bible wrong until it was proven right. They assumed that because they had no secular other writing that old, that the Bible couldn't have been that old either, and it wasn't really written at the time it was written. Now, Moses lived approximately 1500 B.C.,
Weren't there writings on the pyramids by the time that Moses was there in Egypt and
they found
them?
I'm not sure if they'd actually found inscriptions there, but they, but we'll get the number of other examples here that make it real clear. Right. They found, you know, hieroglyphics and things. I'm not sure how they would interpret those. But as far as the advanced writing style and expressing things in language this way, this is what they deny. Okay, now we'll give you a few examples here of what has been discovered since that time to refute this. So far, the earliest document written in Hebrew, now we're just even talking about Hebrew, and Moses didn't necessarily write in Hebrew at all, the original document. But very possibly did. We're not positive exactly, you know, what state the language was in at that time, but we do know this much, that Hebrew, and it could have been Hebrew, that has been discovered, the oldest document written in Hebrew that has been discovered so far is what's called the Gezer calendar. The Gezer calendar. G-E-Z-E-R. That's the name of a city where they found this thing. Most of these things are named after the place that they found them. The Gezer calendar. And this was written about 925 B.C. Now, this isn't back quite as far as Moses' time. However, it was found by a man named McAllister in the 1900s. Some of these I don't have the exact date when they were found, others I do. But a man named McAllister found the Gezer calendar. And the interesting thing about it is that it's a schoolboy's exercise. It's a schoolboy's exercise in Hebrew, dating from 925 B.C. Now, you don't have schoolboy's exercises until a language is quite well developed. I mean, a language, if Hebrew was just crudely being developed at that time, you wouldn't be finding schoolboy's exercises learning Hebrew in school already. So obviously, Hebrew had been around for quite a while before this calendar was written. And so very possibly Moses did write the original Pentateuch right in the Hebrew language itself. Now, this is not all. In 1929, another discovery was made in Rosh Shamra, which is another city in Palestine, and this is known as the Rosh Shamra tablet. We'll be talking about these tablets a little bit more later on, the content of the tablets and what was found in them. But they're also called the Ugaritic tablets, just another name for them. Ugaritic, or Rosh Shamra tablets. Now, these were written in a 30-letter alphabet. It was not Hebrew, but it was the Canaanite language. Semitic meaning coming from Shem. The Semites come from Shem, rather than Ham or Japheth, and just referring to the peoples in that area. This language was more close to Hebrew than any other language that we know of. And these languages, all being so similar, if you learn one language, you could learn the others very easily. Just like the difference between Aramaic and Hebrew. If you know Hebrew, you can learn Aramaic very easily.
Yeah. Were these tablets written in Canaanite language or Hebrew?
It was actually in the Canaanite language. It was a Semitic language. It was very closely related to Hebrew. Very close to Hebrew.
Are you
going to
put a date that he put on, the date that they were written?
I'll get to that here. Yeah. It's about 1400 B.C.
For the writing of these.
And we'll see some of the reasons why. These tablets were mainly religious epic poetry. They refer to Baal. And remember, the Canaanites were worshiping Baal. Baal and El and Asherah and Anath, all these different gods and goddesses that the Canaanites had. We'll talk about these gods and goddesses later on, too, some of the practices the Canaanites had. But they were full of the same sort of depraved polytheism that the Canaanites had at the time of Joshua. And they talk about the very same type of thing that the Bible talks about the Canaanites at the time of Joshua, and they describe exactly what the scripture describes concerning their nature and their practices. And the date is given as 1400 B.C. Yes?
Would it be possible that Moses probably knew about these very documents?
I'm sure they knew about the language, but the important point here is that writing was there. See, these were tablets, epic poetry, 1400 B.C. We're almost right back to the time of Moses now. And the critics claim that writing hadn't been invented yet, see, at this time. We're getting to look more and more foolish as we go. We're not done yet. Okay. The second bell's gone. I'm sorry. We're out of time already. Okay, you have to wait till next time. And we'll find out about the time. When we talk about what some of the Canaanites did in the practices that they practice, you can understand why God told them to be exterminated.
Right.
You won't have any problem at all understanding the mercy of God doing that. Okay, that's all for today.
But unfortunately,
did everybody sign for 3 days? Good.
But unfortunately, the Canaanites became a stone in Israel. Right. And then God became a curse. Sure.
Yeah.